session number 22084, Reel 10.
I might bring you back to the desert situation and then on to the Nino Bixio. On your initial capture, did you understand your position as a prisoner and what that entailed?
Well, I think so. The extent to which I did would be that, firstly, we were to tell them no more than our name and rank. We had to try and escape at every opportunity. That the Italians and Germans both subscribed to the Geneva Convention, so we should expect some sort of humane treatment.
Did you understand what the Geneva Convention involved, what the rules were?
No, really, in a sense, no idea, except that some sort of humane treatment of prisoners. But no, I can't recall them ever being explained to us or ever being given a copy to read. But we bandied the term around Geneva Convention as if it was some great important right and authority for us to be virtually given, if not A class, at least B or C class treatment, which wasn't totally correct.
There'd been, at this point, when you were on the Nino Bixio, there was no point of return. You were leaving the area. As I understand, some people avoided for as long as they possibly could actually getting on board ship. Changing of names and things like that.
Well, there are isolated cases of that happening. And also sometimes I wonder the extent to which that really happened or whether circumstances might have put a particular person in a particular situation where he ultimately justified with a sense of glory. Maybe I might be being a bit unfair, perhaps a bit of both went on. There's no doubt some would try and hang around hoping for survival or to be recaptured or something. It didn't cross my mind, and so I didn't do it. On board the Nino Bixio, it was quite interesting. In that being up on the mezzanine level, and the rest of my company, B Company, were down below. Because of what I'd read in the Reader's Digest about things happening at sea, I took it upon myself to stand on the ladder that ran down to the mezzanine floor. And I spoke to both holes to say that, particularly to the people in the mezzanine floor, we had to the toilet was to go upstairs, and they had a sort of a rigged thing where you sat on this beam and you did your business over the side. That was fine. And you had to go up at a time. You couldn't sort of rush it and get too many people up there. So I did mentioned to them all that when they're going to the toilet, or if they had to go upstairs for any reason, up onto the deck, for the people on the mezzanine floor to use the short ladder, to leave the long ladder for the people down below to get out. Now, in the event of anything happening to us, if we were torpedoed or anything else, that same thing was to hold, that we would use the top level and leave the bottom level, the long ladder, for them. Well, I did cop a bit of flack of that. What's the matter, Sir Major? You got the shit, Sir Major. Well, it's sort of typical Aussie talk. The irony is that the day later, we went on board on the 16th, on the 17th, we in fact were torpedoed. One hit our hold, exactly where the people of my company were. And the other torpedo missed the next hold but hit the engine room. So there was a hold in between which tended to hold up.
What was the general feeling on board the ship before this had happened? What sort of spirits were people in?
Well, I you go with it. You're there, a part of it, and it's happening. But I didn't think. Well, I found myself not too introspective about how I felt about it, and I didn't examine all the others how they felt about it. I suppose most of them were pretty young, anyway, in their 20s or some older people. So that's an interesting question. You'd have to ask each man how he felt about that. But I suppose whatever, going up to action or anything like that, people put on a good front anyway, and they're not going to tell you that they're really scared stiff, or if they're married, they think of their wives and kids and so on. And that I didn't think about those things either. And so I, not having consciously thought about them, or I can't remember thinking about them, I can't project what the mass. But I'm thinking, in retrospect, everyone's pretty buoyant. I can't remember at that point anyone dropping their bundle or at all. No doubt some did. I never saw it. When the torpedo hit, I happened to be reading my paybook, and I've got all the, and I've got this great explosion, and all the stuff went up in the air and down on, and so that the page to which I was open is covered with all these black spots. It's a little reminder. Well, of course, with that explosion, there's pandemonium in the hold itself. Over the top of the hatch, there were short wooden beams. And there are prisoners on top of them, also sitting down there up top. The force of the explosion blew the metal rods that were supporting those wooden beams, wooden short planks, up into the air, and the prisoners on them. And they all came down and crashed down on all the prisoners that were in the bottom of the hold. That was damage one. Damage too was the sheer force of the water and everything else that came in, enormous volume of water, and of course with the torpedo exploding within the hold. And I can tell you that a torpedo exploding inside a confined space where there is a big number of prisoners can be pretty catastrophic. I'll get back to that a little later. The first thing was to get out of that hold. Now,
did you understand what had happened?
Yes, very much. We understood. At least we assumed it would be a torpedo. Everything happened so fast, there wasn't too much logical assessment. We just knew that the ship had been hit and it was going to sink. And so we had to get out of that hold. Well, this might sound like a little bit of glory, but I can assure you it's not bulldust. It's the actual truth that Bill McCoy and I went back into the bulkhead, we were kept pretty close to the ladder, which is pretty obvious. And we'd moved out from there, so we were in a pretty good position by the ladder anyway. But then there was a great rush. Now, the ladder from our deck, the mezzanine down below, had been blown out, so there's nothing to get for the people down below. They were caught down there with the swirling water and everything else. Everybody was crushing to try and get up that short ladder. Well, being a short bloke, I could see that I was pretty close to it, to the ladder, because of where I'd stationed myself. But I knew that with the big blokes clamoring, I couldn't get up, but I saw a sort of a hawser hanging down. So I grabbed it, jumped out and grabbed it and swung out and swung back, and I got out pretty quickly. And once I got up, I got one of these wooden planks to use as a raft. Now at this point, there was only one thought in my mind, and that was personal survival. I had to get off that ship. I went straight to the side of the ship to get into the water. I saw that at the back of the ship, a great number of Indians had jumped overboard, and their turbans were swirling around and so on. I noticed that there were two lifeboats, one either side. The Italians had got to the first one on one side, and the first they were in such a panic that they let one end down faster than the other, so it became stuck with one end up and one end railed down, and they couldn't release it. So their haste robbed them of the use of one lifeboat. On the other side, then those who hadn't got into the lifeboat, none of them had because they hadn't even lowered it, rushed over to the other side with just about as much panic. They let the boat down into the water and they all started jumping into it. That didn't get very far either, I think it capsized. You know, I'm laughing because when you see a lot of Italians panicking, boy, you get panic, you get pandemonium. Anyway, later, well, sometime later, the captain of the ship, a tall, more a Swiss type of Italian, well-trimmed beard and red hair, came down and said in a very matter-of-fact voice, "Well, we're all in the same boat now, men. We're all in the same boat, literally and figuratively we were. But he was calm and in control, and that was great. So different from what we had been seeing of the Italians earlier. Of all those that went overboard, none were picked up, even though there were destroyers, Italian destroyers around us, and Italian planes flying overhead. none were picked up. The only one that I'm conscious of being picked up was a raft with about six people on it, that of our people that got away. One fellow turned up in Italy later, and the story he told was that they just drifted without food and they resorted to cannibalism. Well, I thought to myself without saying it to him, well, you're the last fellow alive, so you must be the best cannibal of them all. Well, that was just interesting. But so looking down at the boat, I saw it started leaning over and noticed there were a lot of barnacles on the side there. So I thought, well, if I go down there now, I'm going to lose a lot of my backside. So I'll wait till it's a little bit flatter, then I'll perhaps be able to slide down more comfortably. Because that's the tide was going out that side. So I raced to the other side to have a look, but that was worse because the boat was leaning over into the water there, and the waves were also that was coming underneath it. So if I jumped off there, would have been washed straight back under the boat. With all this, time was passing. Firstly, once I saw that situation, then I thought of Bill McCoy, my fellows, and so on. But there seemed to be a position that the boat was had lost a lot of its impetus to lean and sink, and it tended to stabilise on a sort of reasonable sort of an angle. I went round, actually prior to all that, looking for McCracken, and eventually found him, and then we realised we had to do something to get the fellows up from down below, so that was pretty horrific. We put ropes onto a broken ladder and lowered it down, and somebody would go down on it and then get a survival and put them on the ladder and be pulled up again. The effect inside was carnage, with all these bodies and real people, wounded people floating around. But inside the ship itself, a couple of unusual things showing the force of explosion. There was one fellow who, the force of the explosion had slammed him against the side of the ship, like a piece of beef, an animal had been cut in half, or he had been cut in half, and one half of it had been slammed onto the side. That's what it's like. There was another person who had been sitting on the beams up top, who had been blown up and got caught in the wires, the hawsers, and it cut him in half, right at the torso. His entrails were around it, and he was in two parts on the deck, the head part of his torso up one end, and the bottom down the other. Well, as I know, as we're carrying the wounded and the dead to up on deck, and I was in front, and I stood on this fellow, the bottom part of his gut. I looked down at what it was, and there it was, standing right on top of him. But that, in that sense, I had my first real lesson in what to do with a lot of dead people. There was a New Zealand sergeant major who were carving them forward and putting these people up between the hatch and the winch. There was space there, and we were laying the dead in there. So he gave my first lesson: make sure that their feet are together and their hands are crossed, so then rigor mortis sets in, they're easier to handle than if they've got their arms everywhere.
I'm interested to talk to you about, you know, you're in this critical situation with maimed, dead, mangled people around you. How does one cope with that situation?
Well, I suppose you cope because it's there. You know, it's, you just do. You just do. There's a job to be done. You're there. You've survived. You're not one of them. I must say, I never felt, when I was looking at that water when the first got out, I never felt a feeling that I was going to die. I never had that feeling at all of panic, or that I was going to meet my maker or anything of that sort. Nothing like that. And you just sort of go through the rest because it's there. The difficult part I found was when night came, we were still on the ship. In fact, we were on it for about another 3 or 4 days, as I recall. And that night, that first night, it was terrible because the combination of three things by this time. I think my head wound had got infected. I had a touch of dysentery. We'd had the torpedoing, you know, and the tension, enormous tension of that day. And then try lying on the deck, trying to get some sleep, and you could constantly hear the voice of somebody saying, "Water, water." So you get water bottle or something and try and give them some water, but comes the stage you just get so shot, you know, you can't do it. You know, there's time when you just got to get some sleep. But anyway, the other factor was the noise of the water coming through, that I remember well, that the big gaping hole of the torpedo, the water surging in there and hitting up against the bulkhead like that, and it seemed to come in with an enormous crash. And in my mind was the thought, well, if it destroys that bulkhead and we have three in a row full of water, we're down. And that was a bit of a worry under that mental stress of that night. That was a hard night that night. Hard night.
Where were you at the time of being torpedoed? Do you recall?
The ship? I think it was initially heading for Brindisi. But somehow we must have been closer to Greece, unless it was their plan to go via Greece. I don't know. But I do know that after the torpedoing, the Italian naval ships had been hanging around, disappeared, because they felt too vulnerable, I suppose, with a pre-submarine there. The ship didn't sink. It floundered. It was taken in tow and taken through the Corinth Canal to Navarino, I think. And we stayed aboard it for a few days. There's still, I can smell that chlorine everywhere. Food was short. And every day was interesting. Well, interesting is probably not quite the appropriate term, but the dead floating up from inside and outside the hole, and corpses would wash out through the hole, and you'd see them floating around. Of course, after 2 or 3 days, they were swelling up and quite grotesque. And I got one fellow, a British tank fellow, I got his black beret. I still have the badge of it. And his brains were still in it, so I had to wash his brains out. I used that. It was quite... Anyway, I felt sorry for him, but, you know, I just have the memento here. And then staying on board there, we weren't given much to eat. We had these very hard Italian biscuits. There wasn't much joy in the food. And then ultimately we were taken off to a small, it looked like a fruit drying hut. And we slept there that night on these angled platforms, angled shelves with a wooden slat at the bottom. No doubt it's where they put the boxes of fruit or whatever. So it was interesting going there to sleep. You had to jack your foot against the rail on the bottom of it and push up and just mentally concentrate when you went to sleep not to lift your foot or head slide off it. It's quite good. It wasn't quite good. No, that's not right. And my memory is not being fair to the...
And I understand you were to identify the dead as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
What did that involve?
Well, firstly, everyone has, every soldier, as you know, has their dog tag. And so you look at their disc and find out who they are. And, of course, a lot of people you recognize. And virtually that. And you hand in their, if they're dead or whatever, you hand in their dog mails, you collect them. We made a list of the people who had been on board the ship and indicating who'd been killed and who was wounded at that stage and so on. And that turned out to be quite an important thing. And I must say the thought of this was Bill McCoy, Staff Sergeant McCoy. He was the one who thought of it. And, of course, a few of us gave him help in determining who the people were.
Do you recall what the list was made up of, numbers in relation to those that had survived and those were wounded and those that hadn't made it?
Well, at the time I didn't, but the list did survive through another one of our fellows, Billy France, who'd been taken prisoner earlier in September 41, and he's the one who'd been brought in front of Rommel. He somehow, I don't know if it got into his safekeeping, but it did, and he brought it back with him, and it's in our particular journal now. I've got evidence of it there somewhere. So this was quite an interesting record.
Just having a look at 10 Platoon at Alamein, which is a book that's been produced by Phil Loftman. He mentions that number one hold was overcrowded with 200 Australian and 304 British and New Zealand troops, and of the 504, only 70 survived. What was the feeling that you were one of those?
I think we were lucky. We were lucky, that's all. We were lucky. And the other thought was, well, if this is God's will, how does he discriminate between the good, the bad, and the ugly? Some of these fellows in my company that were killed were probably a lot better men than me. And that's why I think it's sheer luck. But then everyone has their own belief. And it's, but that gets on to another story. Once we're in prison of war, I'll give you some brief idea of running down that mental road of religion. So,
at this time, you were just lucky to get out of things and to head off. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yes, that would be right. That would be right. It's the interesting thing is that when that tank commander said, "For you, the war is over," he didn't realise for us the war was not starting, but continuing, but in a different sense. Because firstly, we walked through our own artillery barrage. Then I was hit with a bit of flak that was actually aimed at our own planes. Then I was on a ship that was torpedoed by our own submarine. So, and then in Germany, in a bombing raid there, a shell landed not too far from the camp. So, yeah, I think the war was just, hadn't, not over, but just taken a different turn. So,
you mentioned some of the accidents that occur and you just have to put up with them. It would sound, up until this point, your worst enemy was your own, own troops.
After being taken prisoner, yeah, there was. Yeah, and it made me reflect on, really in war, how many people must be killed by their own armies or air forces or right through in every country, allies or not. I think it's an enormous amount of people killed by accident in war. Yeah.
So tell us what happened next. You made it to land. You had slept in a
Well, then we slept in that hut, and then we were taken by a truck through to... where did we sail from? Well, another Italian port, just eludes me for the moment. And en route there, I think I mentioned earlier that as we went through a village, they villagers had trays of water for us and tomatoes and things, but the person in charge of, the Italian in charge of our convoy, wouldn't let us touch any of it. And he jumped down and knocked the water onto the ground, and tomatoes were thrown in from the side of the road, and I bent to pick one up, and the Italian swung his bow at me and aimed his rifle at me, and so I pulled back. I didn't eat that tomato. and then we got on board the next ship to go to Italy. We were heading to Brindisi. Now, the book, the Reader's Digest, had told me also that to be prepared for the event of torpedoing or shipwrecked, always ensure that you have your a jumper tied to your water bottle and have your shoes, your boots unlaced, which I did. What it didn't say, what would happen to you if you were sleeping alongside somebody from the Foreign Legion? Well, I can tell you, the sneaky devil, during the night somehow, cut the strap that held my water bottle and took it and the jumper. I never saw them again. So, well, that was another interesting experience. Never trust the Free French. anyway, got to Brindisi, and we marched through the town there, and as usual we were greeted by usually the younger people. The people lining the street were mixed, obviously, and I noticed that the women looked very sad, and a lot of the older men looked pretty thoughtful. But a lot of the younger ones, men, took great delight in us coming through as prisoners, and they gave that Italian gesture, pushing their hand up forward with a clenched fist and clapping their muscle with the other arm. In other words, you, Jack. And that is enough to make you feel a little bit annoyed. You feel that you'd like to get them on the other end of it and see how they'd go. But there's nothing you can do about it. And I suppose that's one of the most difficult things that I had to learn as a prisoner, was to know when to shut up and back off. Because you're really in a no-win situation. You've really got to go with the flow. When you've got to speak up, you speak up. When you've got something that you have to speak up about, you do. Other than that, you don't go against the pricks or the arrogance of your captors.
So where was your first staging camp in Italy?
First, it was Bari. And we were there for a little while, and the two most interesting things about Bari were the fleas and lice. I woke up every morning with lice on my chest, which surprised me until I found that they're coming from the cord of my dog disc, nesting in this. I still have the dog disc and that cord here, by the way. Well, I won't show you that. The other thing was with the food. Now, this is interesting, that each day we'd get around a small loaf of bread, about a reasonable sized bun, about as big as your fist. And so was given sort of a hut as hut commander, and I had to distribute the bread to my group. And I'd go to each person's palace or bunk where he slept, and I just throw one on the blanket. I never thought about it. I never measured them. And then after about couple of 2 or 3 days of this, so, Major, why is it you're giving me the broken one every day? Why is it he's got the big one next door and I get the small one? Oh, sure. So I found the only way to overcome this was to get all the bread and toss it under a blanket, lay a blanket over it, and each person had to come up and slide his hand under the blanket and no feeling around. He had a feel in, make a grab and come out.